mean, you've been putting in work for so long.
Putting a lot of work.
What's going on, guys? Welcome back to Putting in Work, episode 67 of the interview podcast on the 8-Bit Collective, powered by Audio-Technica. I'm your host, John O'Peck. Today's guest, a very talented man, Anthony Ingruber. We'll get to him soon. But first, the iTunes review of the week goes to Cruise Dog, who says, solid 5 out of 7 podcast, but he did give me 5 stars. Says, Putting in Work is one of the best podcasts I've heard. Great original content. Thanks very much for those very kind words. Now, Anthony Ingruber, if you don't know, is probably best known for playing the Joker or John Doe in Telltale's latest video game, Batman. He features very heavily in Season 2, which wrapped up earlier this year, and he gave an amazing performance as this character we all know as the Joker, but really, this version of the Joker is one that we haven't seen before, and it's a new take on him that Anthony really just brought to life in an incredible way. We'll get into that and what inspired his particular take on the Joker. But I first came across Anthony as an impressionist on YouTube years ago. I just stumbled across his impressions of Harrison Ford and Sean Connery in a Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade scene that he was portraying. I thought it was uncanny. He's probably the best Harrison Ford impersonation I've seen. And it's that impersonation that led him to be cast as a young Harrison Ford in the film Age of Adeline a couple years ago. So this interview is very much talking about, you know, those experiences of growing up, doing impressions of these people that he admired, and then later the opportunity to meet Harrison and meet Troy Baker and work with these people on different projects and, you know, what comes next. Because as much as Anthony's done some really awesome stuff, he's still very young in his acting career, still trying to get his name out there and continue to build up on what's already an impressive resume as far as I'm concerned. This is probably one of the more fascinating interviews I've done. Anthony's had a really interesting life, which you'll hear about in a second. We also wrapped up the conversation with a short discussion about why my favorite film, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, is such a brilliant movie. There are no spoilers for Telltale's Batman beyond what you would have seen in a trailer or something, so don't worry about that if that's a concern. And here is Anthony. Enjoy the show. Thank you for joining me, Anthony. It's awesome to have you on the show.
Hi, man. Thanks for having me.
That's all right. I've never been to Holland. How is it this time of year?
It's getting very warm out of nowhere. It was raining for months, and then the next day it's like, oh, let's go to the beach. Sounds pretty cool.
You're a very well-traveled man. Have you spent much time there before?
In Holland? Well, I've been here for about 4 years. My mom's actually Dutch, so right. a lot of my family's here. So
yeah. Okay. See, I just thought you were like shooting something there, but you actually like live there, right?
Yeah. I live here, and then I go other places when I'm working. So.
Sure. So people who know your name, they may know you from the Telltale Batman series that's just kind of wrapped up its second season, and that was amazing. Have you got anything lined up or announced that you're working on next?
Nothing that I can announce at the moment, but I have a few projects that are pretty cool. And I've got a few irons in the fire. So
excellent. Can you say whether it's kind of voice acting that you're hoping to do more of, or is it kind of a mix of live action as well?
Well, it's a mix of things, but there is a project that I just did. I don't really have a release date on it yet, but it's another voice acting job, and it's another sort of, yeah, I really don't want to spoil it, but it's another comic book kind of character. And yeah, it should be a lot of fun. I really enjoyed doing it.
Excellent. Yeah. I'm not going to draw anything out of you, but I will just say that Telltale seems to use a lot of the same voice actors over and over. Just putting it out there, but hey, we'll see what happens. So let's go back to the start. You've got a very interesting story. I've heard some of it before in previous interviews, but you grew up kind of moving around. Let's hear how you kind of got into acting through that process as well, Anthony.
My dad was... He was an ambassador for the Australian government, that in turn, I mean, I was born in the Philippines because he was posted there. And then I always spent at the most 3 to 5 years in one country at a time until I was in my early 20s. And that was a lot of fun and very rewarding in terms of, you know, seeing the world and expanding your sort of, you know, boundaries, literally. Yeah. But it did mean having to uproot your life and trying to make as many new friends as possible. And that process is always very difficult. But for some reason, I found that one of the constants in my life was film and, you know, doing voices and things. I found at an early age, I would just mimic a lot of what I saw. you know, watching cartoons and TV and stuff, and making my own with a camcorder with my sister, just making our own radio shows and, you know, little films and stuff like that. And I just sort of found that as something that I enjoyed, but it never really occurred to me until I was about 17 that this was something I would really want to pursue. Because through high school and middle school, I would do impressions of actors that I grew up watching, like Jack Nicholson and, of course, Harrison Ford. And this was just a sort of, you know, fun party trick that I used to make friends whenever I had to move. So instead of being, you know, the awkward new kid, I would be the guy, you know, the funny guy who could do the voices, you know, and that was just really fun. But then I started, like, my mom actually had the idea to put the Harrison Ford impression on YouTube, and it got a lot of exposure. And I thought, you know, wow, this is pretty neat. And then when I was 17, after I, right before graduating high school in New Zealand, I was invited to stay, I was invited to visit Weta Workshop in New Zealand, and I met Richard Taylor, and he took us on a tour of the workshop, and that was Disneyland, just seeing the amount of talent and craft that goes into making films, and that was really an eye-opener for me, and I thought, you know, I would love to be in this industry and work among these people, because I just had so much respect for them and admiration for what they can do. And so they took me on as an intern, and I was just, you know, mopping up and scrubbing the floors and stuff, and I was loving it. But then I sort of showed a portfolio of drawings, and I made a DVD of my impressions, and I gave them to Richard, and he really enjoyed them. He's like, oh, that's quite good, Anthony, you know, let's see what we can get for you. So they sort of upgraded me into like the makeup places and helping work on Avatar, which was at the time being in production. So I was able to, you know, I say I worked on it, but really I was just, you know, oh, let me get that for you, you know. But for me, it was amazing. I was just this dorky kid working among these people, and seeing Stephen Lang walk around and, you know, saying, oh, I want to be an actor too. I was like, oh, well, good for you. it's very, I was really trying to, you know, impress people over there. But it was amazing.
Did you get your name in the credits?
No, maybe. I don't know. There's thousands of pages and pages of credits. But I do see myself in that film. I snuck on the set because they needed extras. And the cutoff age was 25, and I was 17. Like, okay, just try to look younger. And I was like, okay, we'll try to look a bit older. So so I got onto the set, which was awesome.
That's cool. You can at least say, you know, I made my film debut in Avatar, James Cameron's Avatar. Yeah. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, in a sea of faces.
And from there, what was the next step to actually kind of get started?
From there, it was just, you know, acting school and in New Zealand, and then trying to get to L.A., but I went to Toronto instead, and I spent 3 years there trying to make it as an actor, but not really getting work. You know, I didn't really have anything, any experience or anything. It was very difficult trying to just get work, and so after 3 years, my visa ran up. And I went home kind of disillusioned and thinking, you know, okay, well, dust yourself off and try to, you know, just keep going. But then a couple months later, I got an email that the director of Age of Adeline, Lee Tolan Krieger, had seen my YouTube videos, because that was the thing that I was doing while I was in Toronto, not getting work. I was pumping out YouTube impressions and film reenactments to keep myself busy and sane and, you know, to stay creative. And he'd seen my Harrison Ford impression, and they sent me an audition, and I got the part. And so I was filming in Canada. So I was just forcibly ejected because my visa ran out. And then 6 months later, I was invited back to film this movie, which was amazing.
Yeah, that's awesome. Like, there's so much from what you said already that I want to unpack. So okay, maybe we'll go chronologically. That's good, though. I want to know, like, do you think moving around and hearing all these different accents and that kind of thing, like, do you think that played into your interest in voices and imitation and that kind of thing?
Oh, certainly. It really, I mean, my accent has changed, has run the gamut since I was a child. You know, my sister also had a very Filipino accent when she was there, when she was three. And then our accents just evolved into Canadian and then Dutch and then Australian and then American when we went to Cyprus and we stayed in an American school. And now it's a sort of mix of all of that.
Yeah, I did notice that before.
Yeah, it still dips into Australian, because I had a very thick Australian accent, but it was something that I also adapted when I went back to Australia from the American school. I still had quite an American accent, but to fit in, I just started, you know, talking in a more Australian accent and, you know, trying to fit in. And it worked. So that was something that I enjoyed and something that was that led to my fascination with accents as well. Just seeing all these expat kids that were my friends from a very young age and being exposed to these different voices was just something that was very interesting for me.
Yeah. I'm really interested in accents as well. And I kind of wonder, like, the transition between accents, like, because you see some kids that grow up, you know, a country and they move and then they just adopt the new one straight away, and then others mm-hmm. that just seem to hold on to it for their whole life. So do you ever, like, question your own identity and when you can notice that your accent is changing, like, who am I really?
Yeah, that's the thing. I was always saying, you know, my passport says Dutch Australian, but I've never lived in this country long enough to identify as either. You know, if people say, where are you from? I always say the country that I'm not in. So if I'm in Australia, I say, oh, I'm Canadian, you know, fuck. You know,
right.
Yeah. I'll just say that, because I don't have the cultural identity to really fit in. Like, I don't feel Dutch. I don't feel Australian. I don't feel Canadian. So I feel, I don't know. It is a bit of a, you know, metaphysical question, who am I, you know, but yeah. Really, I don't know, man.
Yeah. It sounds like a very, like, actory thing to say, like, oh, every role I'm trying just to find myself.
The Daniel Day-Lewis thing. there's a term for it. It's a third culture kid, and that's somebody, okay, that's, you know, the expats and the army brats, as they're called, that from a very young age have just moved around and never had a very solid home base. And that's why I'm very close to my family, because those were really the only people that I had throughout my entire life. My best friends are in Cyprus or in New Zealand, which is, you know, this New Zealand is a 17-hour flight away, you know. Yeah. And I haven't seen him in years. Yeah, so it's quite difficult, but in terms of acting and stuff, it was very good. Training.
We have the internet now, so we can do things like this conversation.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Keep friendships going overseas. Yeah. It is something like that you see with, you know, the top tier actors, that something that separates them from the rest is the fact that they can pick up an accent flawlessly. So I think you're in some good company, you know, with the Russell Crowes and the Sam Neills and the Hemsworths and the Hugh Jackmans of the world.
Australians there, mate.
I mean, you know, I am a little biased.
Yeah, but you're right. I mean, the Australian...
It's a hard accent, yeah, because, like, the Americans struggle to do the Australian accent. Robert Downey Jr. can pull it off, and I'm sure Leonardo DiCaprio could do it, but others have tried and failed, you know?
Yeah, but a lot of Australian actors are... Some of my favorite actors are also Australian, just the list you mentioned.
Eric Banner as well.
Yeah, Guy Pearce. And so, you know, they very... Hugo Weaving, you know, they're all just very good at completely changing their... Persona and accent and just, you know, a bit like Gary Oldman, character actors. I find that so fascinating.
So how did you move from, I guess, an impressionist into an actor? Because as you described it, it was a skill and it was a party trick, but it became so much more. And mm-hmm. it wasn't just that you were impersonating the voices. From the videos I've seen, like the mannerisms and everything, you kind of encapsulated the whole person, and I want to get into that a bit more, but I guess what was it about impersonations that you think led to acting, and what was that transition like?
Well, it's funny, the transition was for my very first acting role was still an impression, you know, Age of Adeline.
Yeah.
they said, you know, okay, give me the grin and, you know, do the voice. And, you know, so, and that was a lot of fun. I mean, everyone was just on the set, I was just doing that voice and a bunch of other voices, and everyone was just having a great time.
And I guess it was like you've just been at acting school for a while and they're saying, go back to doing an impression.
Your impressions, you know, but it was funny because it was really a mix of doing the, because I had very little screen time, and I spoke with the director, what should we do? And he's like, okay, we'll figure it out on the day. And a lot, but really judging by the crew's reaction, they were just really just, you know, just do the voice, you know. And it was really, like, everyone, we were just having a lot of fun.
Yeah. I guess for people that don't know or haven't seen it, you play the young Harrison Ford, like literally.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I should have said that.
That's okay.
But yeah, it was really fun because I remember going on that set and they dyed my hair and they straightened it because I've got very blonde, very curly hair. And they styled me up to look like Harrison. And they played around with having the chin scar, but they ended up not going with that. But my first day on the set, you know, they were in the middle of filming a different scene and I walked on and everyone was like, oh my God, is that, oh my God, you know, and it was really funny. A lot of people were saying to Harrison, you know, they showed him a picture of me because they took reference photos and I was told that somebody was talking to Harrison and they said, hey, Harrison, there's this great photo of you in high school or something. And, you know, Harrison looked at the photo and was like, well, I think that's that kid, you know. So it was really great. It was awesome. And of course, meeting him was just childhood dream.
Does it feel real?
No. It felt completely alien. I was 6 years old, I think, when I saw Temple of Doom. It scared the pants off of me, but I just loved it, and I loved Harrison so much. I thought he was amazing, and he was really my hero. You know, meeting him was I didn't expect to meet him. I thought, you know, we don't have any scenes together, so I thought, okay, you know, I don't think so. And he's a very private guy, and I didn't know if I wanted to meet him because I thought, you know, what if he didn't like me, or what if I, you know,
yeah, what if he's a jerk?
Well, you hear stories of people that don't live up to what your expectations of them are, and I of course didn't want him to think, oh, I should have gone somewhere else. Yeah. So, you know, it was very nerve-wracking, but the crew was like, okay, we're filming his last day. Have you met him? And I said, no. I was like, do you want to? Yeah, but you know, I don't know. But they were very kind, and they were when I was filming my scene, they were behind the scenes texting each other, and like, where's Harrison? Where's Anthony? We got to make this happen. Because they wanted to see what would happen, what would his reaction be to meeting me. So, you know, he rapped. And then they were walking out of that house where they filmed the movie in, and it was that party scene, you know, when they're doing the trivia game. That was his last scene to film, and then he rapped, and everyone was clapping, and I was, you know, standing outside with this sea of people with their cameras because they were all like, oh, we're going to got to capture this. And I was shaking in my boots, like I couldn't see, like my vision was kind of blurry, but I was like, okay, don't pass out, don't make a fool of yourself, be professional, you know. And so he came out, and he looks at the floor like I do when he walks. He looks down, and that's something that I do as well. And so he walks, and then his assistant says, hey Harrison, this is Anthony. And he looks up and he goes, oh, Anthony, I've heard about you. And I just think, oh my God. And I'm standing there, and I shake his hand, and I say, hi, it's such an honor to meet you. I'm such a huge fan, and you know, you were my inspiration to pursue acting. I was like, oh, thank you so much, you're a nice kid. But he was so kind and so gentle, because I always saw him as an action hero or, you know, a rough, you know, but he was such a sweet guy. And so and you know, we took photos but it was amazing. And then, you know, afterwards, of course, it hit me, and I was just emotional wreck. But it was amazing, and I've got the photo hanging on my wall.
I think is that your Twitter photo still?
Yeah, that's still. Well, well, that's one of them. They took a whole bunch, but that's one of them. Yeah.
That's cool. And was it just like a physical resemblance people thought was kooky, or just knowing that you do the impression so well, they wanted to see you guys together, the crew?
Well, they knew that I could do the mannerisms and the voice and you know, the sort of facial things. Like, there's definitely a physical resemblance, but I turn it up because there's certain things that Harrison, I've noticed that he does in his films that you know, is part of the impression. Same as with the Jack Nicholson impression, and that's always really fun because I like to observe the physical qualities as well as not just the voice.
Sure.
But yeah, that was really surreal.
Yeah. Okay, we'll get onto some more of Harrison and Indiana Jones specifically towards the end of this conversation, sure, if you have the time.
Oh, yeah, Anthony, sure. Yeah.
Because that's something that's very dear to me as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess just that transition from, you know, obviously being a notable impressionist to, I guess, what you're doing now in other roles, such as the John Doe character in Telltale and whatever other acting pursuits that you're getting into, like, what was it that you had to learn that has been like the hardest part of transitioning from impressionist to, I guess, actor, yeah, if there is a distinction?
Yeah, well, I still see impressions as acting. I mean, I think it is. I mean, a lot of my favorite actors do amazing impressions. You know, it's pretty cool. But again, with the Joker, it was still the same sort of thing with Age of Adeline, where I found out later that Telltale had seen my YouTube impressions of, you know, Nicholson and Heath Ledger and Mark Hamill. And that was why they were very interested in seeing me, because I auditioned doing the three different impressions, but also my own take on the character of what I thought, you know, my version would sound like. So I submitted all four and I got the part, and I couldn't believe it because I thought, you know, I Troy Baker's in this game, you know, and this is a big game. This is a big game. What are they doing? Yeah. What are they doing hiring me? You know,
and Troy's done the Joker before. So you've got like those.
Troy did a brilliant Joker. So it was very surreal, and but I didn't know which Joker voice they'd landed on, so I assumed Mark Hamill. So I was sort of like, "Hello, I'm going to be talking like this all day," you know, and so I was sort of practicing that. But then I go into the studio and I start, you know, talking like Hamill, and they say, "Wait, what are you doing? What?" And they're like, no, we want the original voice you came up with. And I thought, oh, you know, what? I thought, God, that voice, yeah, what was it? So it was really, it was very last minute as well, because they were already in production, way into production. Episode 3 had already come out. So I really was scrambling on my feet, and it was a very learn as you go, trying to figure out what to do, because they also wanted me to tone everything down. So they wanted me to tone the Joker voice way down, and the laugh as well.
Because I guess that was part of the character, like, evolving into the Joker, right? Yeah.
Yeah, they really wanted him to be sort of medicated and calm and not theatrical. So yeah, that was a bit of a challenge, because I really, from what I knew of the Joker, I sort of filled in my own thing of how he should act and stuff. So this was very different. But the interesting thing between season 1 and 2 was that they changed the John Doe character dramatically as well. Like in season 1, he's a very snarky, sinister, you know, creep. And so that was kind of, you know, he wasn't a very likable character. But then in season 2, they completely changed him again and made him a very anxious, sensitive, nervous guy. And for some reason, that really helped me a lot, because I was able to use a lot of my own insecurities and things I was going through in the performance, because, you know, he was dealing with, you know, he wasn't just a, you know, "Oh, look at me, I'm crazy." He was a guy with schizophrenia and paranoid, you know. So I saw it not as playing the Joker, but playing it as a guy with mental illness, and trying to get it authentic and trying to play him as a human being and somebody that could be seen more sympathetic and like a tragic character than just, you know, this villain, this comic book villain. And so that was very helpful, because also during the time, one of my best friends in New Zealand had passed away. So I was in a very emotional state, and the character demanded that kind of emotion. So it was very, it was sort of healthy to help me deal with these feelings in a creative way. And that was, you know, that was helpful also, you know, to make it authentic, but it was, it was pretty intense at times, but
it's an intense character. So I guess you have to draw on something to you know, convey that. And I think you did an amazing job. I really do.
Thank you.
We mentioned some of the names before of people who've portrayed the Joker, and to say that you're in the same conversation as them is one thing, but I think you really can hold a candle to those other performances as well with what you were able to do with one of the more original takes on the Joker as well, from what I've observed.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, well, I mean, the amount of people who have played the Joker amazingly is very high. There's just so many amazing. I mean, I mentioned Troy and the big three, but also, you know, John DiMaggio and Kevin Michael Richardson. You know, there's so many who have done such a brilliant job over the years. It's very hard to play a character that's so well known and so iconic and then portray him differently. And that was very challenging. Also, it's my first voice job, so it was a big task. You know, I mean, my first job was to play Harrison Ford, and the second was to play the Joker. I mean, it's trial by fire, much, but you know, I'm very grateful.
And just imagine if you'd you know, if you'd ruined that character in some people's eyes. Like, I don't know if you've had any negative feedback, but imagine just the amount of scrutiny that's on something like a DC property would be enormous.
There is a lot of, you know, as you said, there's a lot of scrutiny over things. I mean, I was very pleased with the amount of people in season two who grew very attached to John Doe. And I got some really wonderful fan mail and wonderful messages from people that were legitimately crying at the season finale, you know, and feeling like they lost a friend. And I had the same sort of feeling. It was very strange when season two wrapped. It did feel like I lost a friend. Like, I was playing this guy for a year and a half. And in season two, I really grew attached to him, and it sounds very cheesy, but it was sort of a guy that I sort of grew to know, and you know, I poured a lot of myself into it, so it was really, it was emotional, but I was very happy that people responded so well to him and critically as well, because it was a big risk on Telltale's part to portray him in this way. As opposed to just, you know, the sort of anarchist or the clown prince of crime, but to play him as a guy who's needs friends and stuff. I mean, it was on paper. I thought, what?
Yeah.
But then, you know, it really worked. It was wonderful. I was very grateful to Telltale and to the fan base for giving me the opportunity.
Yeah, that's one of the things I like about the series, is playing with those established characters and presenting them in ways that we haven't seen them before, even with Harley Quinn and Bane, and obviously the whole portrayal of Bruce Wayne himself and his backstory is completely different to what we've seen before. So that's really exciting to see them trying those things. I'm wondering, like, because it's an episodic release, is it something that you record over a really long period of time, or is it done all at once and trickled out?
There's a lot of rewrites and a lot of scripts and stuff, and it did take quite a long time to record everything over the course of a year, I believe. So it's not all done in one big block, but because I mean after especially the later episodes, I couldn't talk, you know, for days afterwards. I spent 4.5 hours in a studio screaming into a microphone and you know, high pitched cackling and you know, and it was very taxing, but really it was very therapeutic and cathartic to get that emotion out. I was really calm outside of the studio, because I used up all that emotion and stuff. And so sitting in traffic and someone cuts you off, I'm like, you know what, I'm going to save this feeling. I'm going to use it later. You know, so it was good.
And is it a recording that's done in isolation, or were you able to spend some time with people like Troy Baker and Laura Bailey?
Unfortunately, no, I wasn't able to record alongside them, but that is done sometimes, but just with time, because Troy is also very busy. But I would have loved to have been in the booth with him. Interacting with him one-on-one, I think that would have been awesome.
I mean, the fact that it comes up with such great chemistry between those two characters is a testament to you guys as voice actors, I guess, that it seems like you are in the same room.
Well, I mean, it was awesome because Troy, I remember when I was in Toronto, I played Bioshock Infinite, and I called my agent at the time, and I said, hey, can I be a voice actor? And she said, no. I said, oh. You know, because it was really Troy was one of my inspirations to pursue voice acting, and to play alongside him and play a character that he played, and of course meeting him in San Francisco, doing publicity with him was just that was also like meeting Harrison. I was just so, you know, it was just surreal, but also a very nice guy and very professional and very talented.
I guess he's the Harrison Ford of voice acting, maybe.
I see him like the Leonardo DiCaprio of voice acting, like that sort of But yeah, like Harrison as well. But yeah,
he's a super talented guy. Very handsome too. Yeah. Have to put that out there.
Yeah, it's disarming, and he's very tall. He's very tall. Taller than me, and I was like, God, you know,
he's aging in reverse as well, I think.
Yeah, that's why I said, like, you know, he's got that DiCaprio thing where he just sort of stays the same age forever.
Mm. So we've talked about two kind of big roles that you've had. I'm sure there must have been a lot of rejection along the way, as there is with, you know, most, or I have to assume every actor, especially young in their career, as you are. So what's that been like, and how have you kind of found the energy to keep pushing through when, especially, I guess, in the earlier days, it seemed like it was a really long road ahead?
Yeah, I mean, I still deal with that. I mean, there's a lot of stuff like that, that, you know, It is very disappointing, and it continues to happen to every actor, as they, you know. But there was a feeling I had as a child that this is what I have to do. You know, it has to be, you know, all or nothing. And even in Toronto, when, you know, I was missing out on toothpaste commercials and things like that, or something, you know, and that was very difficult to take. But I kept busy, and I kept going, and I kept putting my work out there. And if I hadn't done that, if I'd, you know, just folded and said, you know, okay, you know, screw this, I'll do something else, I wouldn't have gotten the offer to do Age of Adeline or The Joker. Like, I decided to have something online, some representation of what I can do that would be public and that would be accessible. And I'm very glad that I did that, because without those two things, I wouldn't have anything on my CV, really. I wouldn't have gotten any kind of exposure at all. You know, I'd just be a name in a book, and there's, you know, millions of people, well, maybe billions probably, that, you know, want to be actors and stuff. So there was something that I needed to put myself in the spotlight a little bit. And, you know, thankfully I did that.
Absolutely. I mean, if the worst case scenario was that you could never do anything again, like, you probably have many great aspirations and dreams, but I think, like, having those two major roles under your belt, it would be a pretty amazing thing to have for the rest of your life. It's a great start.
Yeah, I remember thinking when I got the Age of Adeline, I just thought, you know, there's photos of me when I'm 6 dressed up like Indiana Jones, and if I was to go back in time and say to that kid, hey, you know, one day you're going to meet him and you're going to play him in a movie, what would my reaction be? You know, or, you know, it's very surreal, and I'm very, very lucky in that way.
Very cool. So I guess one of the things with auditioning in and of itself is you're trying to stand out from others. So how do you go about doing that?
Well, that's a million-dollar question. You never know. You never know what the casting director wants. You know, because I, for Harrison, for the Age of Adeline, I knew that just do your Harrison. Mm. You know, that's your trump card. For the Joker, I really didn't know. I thought, okay, well, I can do these impressions, so I'll just attach that, just so they can see that, you know, I'm also a big fan, and it's something that I can do, because, you know, it's something that I've enjoyed. And then thinking to myself, like, okay, you know, you've known this character for since you were a kid, you know, what do you think he sounds like? If he's not Hamill, what do you think he sounds like? You know, if he's not Ledger, you know, what could he sound like? And that was the thing that I sort of thought of. And I had a day to come up with that. And then I decided to submit it immediately and then just sort of forget about it. And so I really sort of tried to think about that. And I didn't really know, especially in season 1. I was sort of trying things out. And of course, it was all subdued as well. But in season 2, I sort of, yeah, I was able to take that seed. And really, when he, one of my favorite things was how different he was from all the other Jokers. And that the anxiety thing that I talked about was very original to this character. I don't, you know, we've seen, like, the Dark Knight Returns kind of Joker, where he's more coma, like he's almost in a coma. But we've never really seen that kind of insecure Joker before, and that was something that I really liked and was able to use.
Yeah, it's kind of like a grounded version of this thing. Like, we're used to seeing this super villain and having no idea how they got there, but we kind of see that here.
Yeah, it's almost like an origin story, but what I liked as well is that it didn't give away too much of his origin, because he still, I still don't know how he looks the way he does. It was never explained. Because in season one, I thought I didn't know what he would look like. So I assumed like John Doe. I thought, okay, he's gonna have, you know, brown hair, and this is gonna be the Jack Napier before he falls into the chemicals. But then I saw it, and he's like, oh, he's already in the chemicals apparently. So my own like fan theory is that he fell into the chemicals years ago before he went into Arkham, but he had amnesia. And so that Joker personality was part of him, part of the amnesia. But because he actively, the John Doe personality, the other side of his brain, wants to be a good guy, but then he's wrestling with, it's a bit like Two-Face, but then he's wrestling with the Joker. And then depending on how you treat him, that personality is going to come out, which one. That's my own sort of theory.
Yeah.
And could be true.
Yeah, we'll see.
Fan theory. Could be true.
Hopefully we can find out more in future seasons. That's my hope anyway.
Yeah, mine too. I really hope so, yeah.
So what would you say has been the greatest challenge to get where you are today?
Just the realities of wanting to be an actor, you know. It's something that requires a lot of persistence and ambition. And really hard work, but also a lot of luck. You know, I got incredibly lucky twice. And that is something that is you can't really bank on luck, you know. And that's, it's very, very draining. And you're dealing with the disappointment and the sort of, you take things on very personally as well. You know, with rejection and things like that. And that's very difficult to go on, like any job, I guess. But when you sort of put yourself out there in a performance or something, and then it's rejected, it can be very disappointing, especially if you see something that you really want and then you don't get it. That's that. And you know, especially early on when that is all you get, you know, it's very easy to fold. But I think, you know, wanting something that bad and having the ambition and the talent to try to go for it is, you know, what you really need fundamentally. If you don't want it bad enough, I don't think it works. I don't think it happens. But there is also the luck element. So,
and you can't force that, can you?
No. Well, I don't know. I mean, monkey, like a little rabbit's foot, and you know, all these you stockpile all these charms, but no, you got to be lucky. Yeah.
And what would you say would be your advice on that to people who are trying to break through the way you have?
I think my best advice would be the opposite of the advice that I got. Don't delete your YouTube channel, because I got that advice by somebody before I got Age of Adeline. And if I'd listened, I wouldn't be talking to you right now, and I'd probably wouldn't have this career. So, I think your best advice is to find your strengths and make it public. Try to promote yourself. Try not to rely too much on other people doing it for you, because I think you're your own best publicist. I think that perseverance, you know, but I mean, it's hard, but I mean, I'm still very new to all this, so I don't have a wealth of knowledge to impart upon the young kids, you know, but
I mean, you're probably where a lot of people want to be, despite not being maybe where you want to be necessarily in terms of the gigs that you're picking up. Like, I think people that are just starting out would especially relate to what you've been able to achieve so far.
Yeah. I mean, everyone sort of starts in the same place, I suppose, unless you're, you know, the son of a casting director or something, you know, unless you have that edge. But yeah, everyone sort of starts in the same way. And something that I found really encouraging was a lot of actors that I admire, you know, Harrison Ford, they started later, you know. Michael Caine, Clint Eastwood, they all got their start when they were, you know, late 20s, early 30s, or even later. You know, Samuel L. Jackson, I think, was 40. And Ricky Gervais, you know, all these big success stories, they weren't all child stars. So, you know, it can take a while. But that was encouraging for me. I made a list of actors that I really admired that started later, like Michael Caine. You know, most of the guys that I do impressions of, actually, pretty much all of them. You know, they all started later. Yeah,
I do like that fact. a lot of people I see on social media are kind of freaking out about turning 30 or whatever it is. And I like to, you know, remind them, as I reminded myself when I turned 30 last year, that Harrison Ford was 35 before anyone knew who he was. So, you know, you've got time.
Yeah. I mean, it's not 30. Yeah, I don't know. It's not really. I've still got 2 years to go until I hit 30, but.
Well, you've got 7 years on Harrison Ford then.
Well, that's another thing. I didn't think about that. Yeah, that's pretty cool. But it's really, I mean, that list of actors and stuff, that's just really encouraging to see that it's not like, oh, I haven't made it by the time I'm 25, so it's not going to happen. You know, it can happen tomorrow or it can happen in a couple of years, you know.
Great. It's a funny thing, like you're talking a lot about the impressions, and that's actually where I first came across you. It must have been one of the Indiana Jones, Harrison Ford, Sean Connery impressions, maybe 5 years ago. And, you know, I didn't memorize your name or anything, but this is a huge coincidence. For some reason, I thought I remembered that video. I looked it up. I watched it. And then the same week, I saw you on the Game Over Greggy show, which I'm a huge Kind of Funny fan. And they were talking, I was like, I didn't recognize the name, but as soon as they started talking about you, I was like, I know this guy. What? He's the Joker? Because I'd already played Batman.
Oh, really?
First season. And I was like, wow, that is such a huge coincidence. I cannot believe that of all the impressionists on YouTube, the one that I felt really drawn to was yours. And I think, you know, we've talked a lot about Harrison Ford, but like you said before, there were some mannerisms there that just blew me away, whether it was like the incredulous grin, responding to, you know, his dad asking him what he wants to talk about in that blimp scene.
Yeah.
Like just as someone who's a huge fan of those films, I just thought, yeah, you really were like honing in on some of those details.
Yeah. I think it's from the childhood of just watching those films all the time, because that was my childhood, you know, watching those movies and watching those actors. And, you know, same with the Joker, like grew up with Hamill and Heath and Jack and stuff. And then you just, yeah, I don't know. I do that as well. I have a girlfriend as well. And I sort of mimic her as well. It's like little personality traits and things that I notice that most people like, well, not most people, but that some people don't really pick up on. And it's really cool to sort of be able to see that and then incorporate that into the impression. That's really, yeah, I really enjoy doing that.
Yeah, it's those small things, I think, that, you know, separate an impressionist from someone that's kind of just good at doing one line or something. Like, you're doing these whole scenes and every second person you meet has a Christopher Walken impression, but you hear a good one and it's like, oh, wow, that guy's actually found something there.
Yeah, the thing is that Christopher Walken, I can't do him, really. Like, not in a way that, because everyone, I say like, oh, I do impressions, like, oh, do Christopher Walken. I'm like, yeah, no, he's not on my wheelhouse, really.
Yeah.
But like, but everyone sort of does him, but yeah, I've never really been able to.
Well, not a lot of people do Harrison Ford, so you found your niche and your first gig, so.
Yeah.
Well done. So I'll ask you the final question that I ask everyone, and then we can go on to talk about my favorite film of all time.
Okay.
Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Okay.
Anthony, if you could do anything and know that you wouldn't fail, what would you do?
Oh, wow. I think I would start my own production company that would develop AAA games and movies and TV shows and things like that, and just cast friends of mine and other actors that are struggling to get a break in the industry, just because I know how hard it is. And there's a lot of very talented people that I know that you know, are struggling to find to get the break that I did. And I just think it's important to kind of support each other, and I think it'd be really awesome just to work with my friends and make something really, really cool. Yeah,
fantastic. Is there a dream film project or acting gig that you'd love to be part of?
Well, I really, on my bucket list, is to do full motion capture voice acting. You know, like Andy Serkis kind of stuff. That would be amazing. I would love to do that.
There seems to be a lot of opportunities for that in like the big video games, like the AAA.
Yeah,
games.
Yeah, I would love to break into that as well and just do a full motion capture performance for, you know, big AAA game, that would be definitely one of my things. Yeah,
I think having Troy Baker's phone number, if you do, would be a good start to that.
I was toying with the idea of, for publicity, of leaving him voicemails as John Doe, like at the end, like at the beginning of episode 5. Yeah. But I thought, no, that's probably not a good idea.
Sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, I thought it would have been funny, but he, I don't know him well enough. If I could get away with it.
He seems to have a good sense of humor.
No, he's a really nice guy.
Sure. Yeah. So let's get into what I really want to know from you. What makes The Last Crusade such a great film? It is my favorite movie of all time.
Yeah, I'd say it's up there with me as well. I'd say it's probably the dynamic between Sean Connery and Harrison. I would say that. The father-son aspect. Also, it seems to be more lighthearted and more of an adventure than the other ones, especially Temple of Doom, which was more of a horror film. But I'd say it's definitely the sort of lighthearted, you know, the theme song and everything is just so rousing is the word.
It really is.
Yeah, I think it's great.
People often say that Raiders is the best of the trilogy, but I'll defend The Last Crusade till like my dying breath, because I feel like it's such a more fully formed character that we get to see in that film. We get a backstory, we get motivations besides treasure hunting. We get to see, you know, where he came from, why he is the way he is. And that fleshed out character makes it so much more engaging. And I think, like you mentioned with the father-son dynamic, every one of my favorite scenes is a conversation, whether it's sitting in the motorbike before they go back to Germany, whether it's the two of them tied up in the chairs together before setting the place on fire, whether it's the two of them on the blimp just talking. And I think that those two characters, and I guess those two actors, are so, they're such huge personalities, and they do such a great job of making it believable.
Yeah, it's the chemistry as well. They just play off each other so well. And it's such a... I would say it's my favorite of the quadrilogy, or soon to be... What's 5? Is it anthology?
Is it Quinn?
Yeah. Quinn. What's an anthology then? What is that?
An anthology is like a Black Mirror, where every episode is unique, I guess.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. Or like Twilight Zone or something like that. That's my understanding.
Yeah. It sounds a bit like Anthony. It's weird. But I would say it's my favorite out of them, just because it's lighthearted and it's very warm. And it's kind of like a feel-good thing. Except the part that scared me was when the guy turns into a skeleton when he drinks the Grail.
Yeah.
Donovan.
It's scary.
That's scary.
They all have
that moment, the face is melting, and then it's pretty.
It's part of the formula.
It's gruesome. Yeah.
They're the bits that I remember as "Look away at this part, son. You're not allowed to watch this."
Yeah, don't watch this. Yeah, yeah.
I want to know, as someone that's got Harrison Ford very near and dear to you, how you feel about these ideas that are being mentioned a lot, of the series continuing without him after whatever the next movie is. Spielberg's talked about doing more indie films without Harrison Ford. Maybe, a couple of years ago they were talking about recasting a younger actor to play him. And then Spielberg's just thrown out this idea of a female Indiana Jones as well. So, yeah, I'm curious what you think as a huge fan of not only Harrison but the series.
Oh, I haven't heard about the female Harrison Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he said we'd have to call her Indiana Joan. I think that was kind of a dad joke there, but...
Indiana Joan, okay. Yeah. I'm not sure. All I heard was that he was going to do the fifth one, which would be... he did The Force Awakens and he was really good in that, so, I think it could work. Mm-hmm. And he just did... I just saw Blade Runner 2049, and that was... I saw it in the theater twice. And that was my favorite film of the year. It was brilliant. So I think he's definitely got it in him still to do another one. But as so far as recasting it or moving on, I don't know. They would do it anyway. They're going to do it anyway. I don't know. But I would look forward to seeing another Indiana Jones with Harrison in it. Definitely. Yeah,
me too. A lot of people will say Crystal Skull was so bad they need to just stop. But I have that sense that there's some redemption there that needs to happen. And I think that we're in an age now where we've seen what J.J. Abrams did with episode 7 of Star Wars, and how that focus on practical effects and being true to the originals has kind of come around so much compared to, I guess, the era we were in with Crystal Skull. And I guess it was like just after those, the Star Wars prequels as well. And the two series are tied in many ways with the George Lucas connection, I think. But yeah, I feel like they can definitely end it on a high note rather than what we had with Crystal Skull, which I don't hate like many people do, but it definitely didn't capture the magic of the trilogy, did it?
I didn't hate it. I was 18 or something when I saw it in Cyprus in the theater. And I enjoyed it because simply for the fact that I'm seeing an Indiana Jones movie in the theater. You know, that was a new thing for me. And yeah, but it was definitely different sci-fi. But I saw it more as in the original three were the sort of 1930s pulp adventure. And then this one was, you know, in the 50s, which was sci-fi. And those sort of campy, low budget, you know, them and they live, or, you know, no, they live was that 80s film. But, you know, those, you know, it came from the swamp, like those sort of movies. Yeah, and so sure. I sort of see it like that, like a campy, fun sort of film.
I guess it was like the special effects and the use of the green screen and that kind of thing that for a lot of people made it feel less like one of those classic films. And that's kind of unavoidable these days with the way that films are made. But I think, like I mentioned, episode 7 did a great job of combining the practical effects with what we can do now with CG.
Yeah, balancing it, yeah. Yeah, I prefer practical just because, like, you know, and what a workshop seeing the practical effects was very, yeah, it's just, there's something, because it's there, you know, it's actually, you can see it, you know, and it's got a weight to it, you know. And that's really cool. It's like authentic.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks for talking Indiana Jones with me, Anthony. Thanks for indulging.
Yeah,
me.
Man, that's all right.
And thank you so much for sharing your story. It's a really amazing story to go from doing impressions of Harrison Ford to being paid to act in a movie with him, and then what we've seen with everything we've covered in the Telltale Joker game. I hope there's a lot more to come from you, and I'm sure that there will be.
Oh, thank you so much, man. Thanks for having me. It was great talking to you.
Thank you for listening, and thanks to Audio Technica. You can find today's guest over on Twitter at Anthony Ingruber. Make sure you don't miss Telltale's second season of Batman with Anthony's amazing performance as the Joker. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider a rating and review in iTunes, or if you really enjoyed it, you can pick up some awesome Putting In Work merchandise over at 8bit.net/PIWATEBIT. The show is part of the 8-Bit Network, so while you're over there, check out the rest of the awesome content from the 8-Bit Podcast Collective. You can catch me over on Twitter at Jono himself, and until next week, keep putting in work.